Everybody on tape? Good. You're taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Cooperative presents Earth on the Air.
During the next 30 minutes, Earth on the Air's independent contributors visit a community of environmental activists that was infiltrated by the FBI.
We'll check in on the Wise Use Movement, which says, among other things, that environmentalists would like to see a world without people.
We'll talk about developmental aid in third world countries. Does it do more harm than good?
Also, an update on the forced relocation of Navajos and Hopis from the Big Mountain area of Arizona.
And more. First, fresh thoughts from the streets about an old legend.
You familiar with the David and Goliath story?
Yeah, I think I am.
How's it go?
Well, David killed Goliath with a slingshot.
I guess it's the little man versus the big man. Little man wins.
And Goliath was like terrorizing everybody, and David's like, I'm not going to take this anymore, you know?
So they sit him down, and he...
Yeah, he defeats Goliath.
Right.
The little puny guy. The underdog, so to speak.
Any modern-day David and Goliath stories you'd like to share with us?
A Native American making it in the business world.
The government versus the people.
Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill.
Hussein and Kuwait. But then David needed a little help.
Democrats versus the Republicans.
The AIDS problem, the way people get treated.
Economics. Monopolizing third world countries. Ever since Reagan-Bush era, it's been really hard on these issues to stop the big boys from squashing the little ones.
Are there any modern-day David and Goliath stories?
Well, women would be the David, and the animals would be the David, and big business would be Goliath.
Big males, you think they're hot and go around and bash on women that can't defend themselves.
There probably are David and Goliaths, but they really don't tell us about the Davids, because then we would recognize that there's a Goliath.
There's not that many Davids, I don't think.
Right. A David comes from within yourself, and there's so few men that are like that anyway.
Actually, in a lot of ways, I am both. I'm a result of society and my environment, but I believe that my dream, my vision, is my David.
The small fish will either fail and die, or he'll learn and grow and become a great person. So the
but
more
he'll
that
never become a big fish. He'll become a great fish, but not a big fish.
Right, but it's depending on what you want to be, a great fish or a big fish.
Or a pretty fish.
A pretty fish is are superficial.
I think I'm a David. I think I always have been. But we all think of ourselves that way. I mean, Bruce Coburn has a song about that. It says that everybody wants to see justice done on somebody else. And that's as true for me as everybody else, except for some. It depends on which side of the tracks you're on. And on one side of the tracks, you can carry out the justice. The other side, you're a victim of it.
What's been done in the name of liberation? And in the name of civilization? And in the name of race? And in the name of peace?
Environmentalists tend to portray themselves as protectors of defenseless nature against big business behemoths. But as the movement toward preservationism grows stronger, some people are saying that picture's turned upside down.
If you want to reduce environmentalism to a bumper sticker slogan, it would go like this. Nature is good, man is bad, man is destroying nature, man must be stopped. Well, we don't agree with that. To take the Wise Use Movement, which is, I guess, the growing movement in the United States that's kind of a reaction to environmentalism, we think that one can love nature without thinking that man is evil. One can believe that nature is good, man is good. Man and nature can live together in productive harmony.
Ron Arnold heads the nonprofit Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise, based in Bellevue, Washington. It boasts about 20,000 dues-paying members nationwide. The group publishes books about the wise use movement, which says that economic concerns should outweigh preservation. Here's a snapshot of the wise use movement, recorded by an environmentalist, Ted Jessen.
Environmentalists are like drivers who can only put the brakes on. They don't know how to steer. They refuse to step on the accelerator. When people see that it's nothing but negativism and that it has no merit to it, and find that even though it's not, it doesn't have that wonderful rush of adrenaline playing on fear, hate, and revenge, which is all that environmentalism has to offer, they will abandon that in favor of a wise use philosophy. There is a substantial danger of environmentalism becoming the next Marxism, because it convinces people so powerfully. You see, the real danger in the world of ideas is not ideas as themselves, but ideas that convince so powerfully people are willing to do anything to achieve them. John Muir once said, any fool can destroy a tree, it can't run away. Well, the same thing is true about a corporation. Any fool can destroy a corporation, it can't run away. Best way to avert ecological disaster is private property, where you have something that people have a sense of commitment to, ownership in. So we would think that if people enjoy hiking areas, say for example, they should own them. What is economic growth? It's the adventure of the spirit of human beings. Man and nature are not different things. Man is nature waking up. Maybe global warming would be a good thing, because you stop and think, when we think of global warming, you think the world's going to become a desert. No, that's not right. Deserts only happen when it gets cold. So the Sahara Desert could again be the Sahara Forest or the Sahara Plains or the Sahara Garden. What are we afraid of in CO2 accumulations creating global warming? Maybe we should do it on purpose. Don't just assume that because it's a pesticide that you have to stop it, that you have to get off the planet with it. That's just not the way the real world is. Everything, including pure oxygen, is toxic at a high enough dose. One of the things that I've noticed since the days that I sat on the board of the Sierra Club is that when it comes to fighting against environmentalists, they've got all the brains and all the money on their side, and we seem to have all of the Neanderthals who won't give a dime on our side in the wise use movement. It's hard not to admire the huge minds that these people have, the ability to devastate industry so perfectly, to target their legislation over 50 years and 30 to 40 different laws in an unfinishable agenda that just keeps pushing industry farther and farther to the wall and destroying more and more of the infrastructure of the human economy. I've been called in the middle of the night to go out and take the gun out of the hands of a friend. And I tell them, we don't do violence. Let the other side do that, no matter how much you disagree with them, or no matter how much they harm you. We think that these people are probably, even though they have been glamorized by the media, are probably going to be one of the cracks through which we will eventually let all of the water out of environmentalism and take its money and members away from it and destroy it once and for all.
Ron Arnold is the director of the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise.
I've done lots of spiritual healing. I'm in touch with all my feelings. I've read palms and read the stars for kings and queens. And I hate to bum you out, but you have without a doubt the ugliest aura that this poor girl's ever seen. 'Cause I can see your aura and it's ugly. Your spirit must be rotten too.
That's Peg Millett. Her song is dedicated to FBI Special Agent Michael Fain, who infiltrated her Earth First group, became her friend, and eventually helped arrest her and other Earth Firsters in 1989. She's now serving a 3-year prison sentence for conspiracy to cut down a transmission line at an Arizona water station. Millett and other Tucson-area Earth Firsters who were not arrested share their impressions first of Agent Fain and then of two informants who supplied information to the FBI, leading to the 1991 convictions of the so-called Arizona Five. Gene Eisenhower, a Tucson-based community relations consultant, conducted the interviews.
The thing that really connected me to him or gave me the impetus to want to be involved with him or want to be helpful to him was I like to rescue people, or I did. So he came on as a stray, as a drifter. I had identified with that because I was a stray and a drifter for many years in my own life.
He definitely presented to Peg a very kind of lost soul, a searching person. He really appealed to Peg's, you know, for lack of a better term, mothering sort of instinct.
And so I was salving the wound kind of bull. It just makes me want to puke now when I think about how I really just gave away my power to this person.
And he was kind of shy, not very talkative, kind of sat back and watched, and I thought, actually, Rod and I later, I think, even that evening thought, you know, interesting, he might be a spy, you know, he's the right era and blah de blah, and we definitely had talked about it and considered it, and we didn't consider it very seriously because so what if he was? We knew that there were probably spies everywhere.
And so there he was, drawing that part of me, the sickest part of me, out to be more sick. I knew there was something wrong in my heart of hearts, in my guts. There was always this nagging doubt that I just never paid attention to it.
She was a character. She used to hang around camp, around the campfire, smoking a pipe. Sometimes it would have tobacco and sometimes it would have other things, which I thought was ironic later because we found out, of course, she was an FBI agent. And here she was packing her pipe full of funny little green stuff.
I kind of liked her. She seemed to always, she laughed a lot, seemed to have a lot of fun with people.
I guess especially I got to know her well because she was very musical. And I would pull out my guitar around the campfire, and she did these wonderful harmonies and had a great voice. She had kind of a gypsy soul, and so she'd hit all the harmonies and give it that real minor, lonesome feel.
She'd invite you over, try to gain your trust, compliment your children.
A lot of people were angry at her. I felt sympathy for her. It was kind of a pitiful situation that a person could be placed in a situation where they have such low ethics in dealing with other people.
Over the course of the dinner and beyond, she would try to get you drunk, you know, and then after she figured, you know, you were in the right kind of head space, she would start pumping you with questions about monkey wrenching. And
she spoke at a function, which was a reading by Ed Abbey, a speech by Dave Foreman, and a little performance musically by Bill Oliver out of Texas. Well, she introduced Bill, and then Bill played a bit, and then she got up and she would tell a joke or a story, and then Abby got up and read excerpts from his book, I think Hayduke Lives, which was a chapter from, was written about the 87 Earth First Rendezvous. And Ed Abbey, in his reading and in his writing, was the protagonist in the story, were FBI agents. Well, Abbey had no way of knowing that in reality there was an FBI agent who was introducing him.
He was a very strange man and a very interesting guy. In fact, it was later shown in court that during the whole time he was at the rendezvous in the 87 Earth First Rendezvous, he was tripping on acid the whole time, and you know, which may explain some of his irrationalities at the rendezvous and how he interpreted things there. You know, because that's where he allegedly decided that Earth First was a bad group of people, and he was so paranoid that he felt that if it weren't for the fact that he had been able to go to the FBI, which he claimed that he did without any kind of instigation from the FBI or whatever, that he would have pulled a quote unquote Rambo, which came out to mean that he would have taken a weapon and gone to the Earth First Rendezvous and started randomly killing people. You know, and this is the person the government based their entire case on. But not only did they base their entire case on him, but over the last 3.5 years, they paid him $54,000 of taxpayers' money.
He was an artist. He could do good graphic art, but he shined in Celtic designs. That was what endeared me to him. Although in many ways, he was just a little off kilter.
My initial reaction was that he was sort of on the verge of psychotic. And I think, sure enough, that's my second and third and fourth reaction, that he is a psychotic.
I'm just going to deal with people with a lot more caution. You know, you're used to joking around with people and saying things off the cuff like, you know, goddamn Bush. I wish the damn White House would just blow to bits, you know? And you can't say stuff like that anymore because so much of that court text was taken out of context to make it sound like these people perhaps are violent. And that's not the case.
This has really tarnished me and made me incredibly cynical and very frightened for our country. I mean, I'm not worried about communism, and I'm not worried about, but I'm definitely worried about fascism and people like Mike Fain, who have no souls, who would work for Ceausescu, who would work for Stalin, who would work for Adolf Hitler, and who are now working for George Bush. And that, to me, is very, very frightening.
Grow up to be a spy, maybe just before the FBI. So I keep myself a real close eye on nice folks like you. I'll talk to people and I'll write notes down. At other times I kind of sneak around, and if there's anything to be found, I'll know where and by who.
You've been listening to Arizona Earth Firsters Rod Mont, Nancy Zierenberg, Scotty Johnson, Lynn Jacobs, and Peg Millett.
Next on Earth on the Air, Russell Gasser. He's co-founder of a program in Nicaragua that trains wheelchair users to fix wheelchairs. But just because he's a Westerner doing meaningful work in a struggling country, don't call him an aid worker. He hates that.
I would not call myself an aid worker. I'm just a worker. I'm just taking a job. The fact that I happen to be doing a job outside my own country is neither here nor there to me.
Gasser calls himself an internationalist, someone who lives and works in another country as an equal to share knowledge and culture. Most organized aid agencies, Gasser feels, are unable to carry out useful missions in developing countries. One reason is that aid workers usually live much more comfortably than the people they're training, which can appear unjust and get in the way of the work. Gasser lives in a simple one-room house in the Managuan barrio, where the wheelchair workshop he helped establish is situated.
Financial worries are a major part of people's lives for the vast bulk of people on this planet. And until you actually start worrying, well, do I have enough to eat? You know, can I afford to go out to a movie? And all this sort of stuff. You're miles from where those people are.
But Gasser's biggest gripe with developmental aid organizations is that they interfere when they shouldn't. For example, in Nicaragua, he says he witnessed the U.S. Agency for International Development, AID, effectively squelch a grassroots-based project that showed promise.
A group of war-disabled veterans in Nicaragua started up a little home workshop or small workshop making electrical insulators for fitting power lines to power posts. This was the first insulator manufacturing in Central America, and it was really a home workshop, and their quality wasn't great, but it was kind of okay. Within 3 months, AID had negotiated a new aid package which included long-term soft credits for the purchase of US-made insulators at zero immediate cost and at very, very favorable terms in the long range. Of course, the electricity supply industry in Nicaragua is really strapped for money, so it has to get its insulators from the cheapest source, which are the ones available free or on long-term credit. So the first insulator manufacturing plant in Central America collapsed immediately because they could not get any orders. The fact that it happens over and over again, and this is only one example out of many that I could give you, leads me to believe that it is no coincidence, it is deliberate policy, that the purpose is to help, but to help in a way that encourages dependence.
And dependence on wealthy countries, Gasser says, is precisely what developing countries do not need. So how to help a struggling third world community? Russell Gasser says, encourage self-reliance.
Get them to define their own terms and do it, even if they know and I know this is not how I would have done it. It's more than just letting them do it. It's giving them the rights and insisting that they take the responsibility.
And ultimately, Gasser says, if you really want to help developing countries, concentrate on your own country.
The real work and the real problem and the real solution lies not in changing the poor countries, it lies in changing the rich countries. And people in the US and Canada and Britain and Germany and France and wherever who are really trying to change the system, really trying to educate people, really trying to teach people to use public transport and not use their private car to go to work every day, people who are promoting Clean Air Acts, people who are promoting better housing standards, people who are fighting the importation of ivory. This sort of thing is actually where you make the difference. And that's where the cutting edge is. People like me, off in the tropical countries, sitting under the banana trees, having fun, you know, it's nice and it's very emotionally appealing, but it's not where I think we're going to be able to change the world.
We was all scared.
Burger, fries,
there's never been a better time to buy.
This is from the soundtrack of a video put together by the Media Foundation of Vancouver, British Columbia.
They've produced a series of hard-hitting television ads against TV addiction. They've also made ads promoting a sustainable planet.
Here's an example. The video features a clay animation pig erupting out of a map of North America.
A tiny 5% of the people in the world consume one-third of its resources and produce almost half the non-organic waste. Those people are us. Nothing is destroying this planet faster than the way we North Americans live.
The Media Foundation is providing the ads free of charge to people who will purchase advertising time in their local TV markets. A 30-second ad can run as low as $40 in most cities.
If you want to find out more about the Foundation's ad campaign, look for its magazine, Adbusters.
Next, in the northeastern corner of Arizona lies the so-called Joint Use Area, the home of both Hopi and Navajo tribes. In 1973, the U.S. government split the reservation in two, ostensibly because the two tribes couldn't get along. Families who lived on the wrong side of the new dividing line would have to relocate by 1986. But many have refused to give up their homes, like Louise Benally, a Navajo living in the region known as Big Mountain. She says her people are not moving, period.
We intend to resist and live the way we always have lived, and we have been ready for the last 10 years, and we're still ready. We will, you know, be dragged out of the area and, you know, be pushed or shoved or hauled past the fence line.
Benally says there are about 300 families that are refusing to move, and that the U.S. government is continually stepping up efforts to carry out the relocation. It's now illegal for joint use area residents who are slated to be moved to build new houses or improve old ones, and they've been ordered to reduce their cattle by 90%. The U.S. government has recently started impounding livestock. But what really enrages Benally is the whole premise behind the relocation, that the Navajos and the Hopis were incapable of living together in harmony.
We're relatives, and we have always lived side by side as neighbors, and the government policies drew a line calling it a Navajo-Hopi land dispute, but what it is a line drawn by the Navajo and Hopi tribal government for the big energy corporations to develop, and the Navajo and Hopi tribes are being used as an excuse to divide this land and to develop it.
Politics, Benally insists, is behind the forced relocation of Big Mountain residents. She says tribal governments accountable not to the tribes, but to the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs and their own self-interest have leased areas like Big Mountain to mining companies like Peabody Coal. Many Navajos and Hopis agree with Benally that their shared homeland is being destroyed in the name of an intertribal dispute fabricated by non-Indians who see the land only as a cheap source of energy. Benally says it's sometimes very difficult to struggle against those that are trying to remove her people without feeling hatred for the whole white race.
When I see a federal official that comes to, you know, tell us that we're not supposed to be living there, then I have hate in my eyes and I have, you know, anger in my heart, and I'm ignorant, I'm racist, and I'm sexist. I cannot understand why they have come here and supposedly discovered us, but we discovered them, you know, being lost, and our people helped them. 500 years later, you know, throughout the 500 years, all they've done is committed a big crime. There's no balance in the white man's society because everything's about destruction of the land, the air, the water, people's lives.
Louise Benally considers herself a traditional Navajo resident of Big Mountain, Arizona. She was interviewed by Seattle French teacher Jean-Paul Bardou.
This is Jean-Paul Bardou with an astrological perspective. You may know that we are entering a new era, the Aquarian Age. Eras are astrologically determined slices of time lasting about 2,000 years each. Aquarius is characterized by a search for truth, world building, a pursuit of ideals, even at the price of becoming a social outcast. We are exiting the era of Pisces, characterized by martyrdom, struggling for a reference point in a sea of feelings, as a fish in the water. The fish, in fact, is a strong symbol for one of these eras' defining worldviews, Christianity. An important myth from that era comes from the Old Testament. The Philistine Goliath is a fearsome monster that would scare Arnold Schwarzenegger himself. David is a mild shepherd. Against all odds, David takes on Goliath. As we are now switching eras, let's consider this story with the new perspective in mind. Is it an appropriate myth for the Aquarian Age? Perhaps with some revisions. Examples of how we can transform the metaphor are available in other cultures. The Sinoy tribe of Malaysia uses dreams as a teaching method. A child is encouraged to revisit the terrible tiger that appeared in a dream the night before and confront it, but not to slay it with a sling. The child's challenge in a later dream is to befriend the tiger, turning it into a powerful ally. A pretty radical departure from the old biblical story, huh? But we're hearing a lot these days of new paradigms, new ages, new world orders. This is probably a good time to explore what these phrases really mean.
That's the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Don't forget, this is your program too. Send for a copy of our submission guidelines or find out more about any of the pieces you heard.
Write us at Earth on the Air, P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145.
That's P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington 98145.
Earth on the Air's submissions director is Susan Gleason. Our executive director is Craig McDonald. The show is produced and edited by Peter Maloff.
We had help from Bill Svoboda, Scott Bergen, Tom Baer, and Ted Gates.
Additional music was by David Hines, Steve Clark, the Penguin Cafe Orchestra, and Randy. Production facilities provided by Jack Straw Productions in Seattle and KSER in Linwood, Washington.
Partial funding is provided by the Town Creek Foundation.
If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-735-0230. Mention that you'd like program number 11. For the Earth on the Air Radio Cooperative, this is Janice Kane.
And I'm Peter Maloff.